Good morning, brethren. It's certainly a great privilege to be with you and to share with you in the blessings of the convention. I'm certainly indebted to Brother Duane and Sister Judy for their warm hospitality and for their sweet fellowship. I'm indebted to the Connellsville Ecclesia to be here with you all. And I bear with me the love and greetings of the little fellowship with which I'm privileged to meet, the brethren of the Jersey City Ecclesia. And their practice is to convey their love and greetings to you by virtue of Scripture. And for this month, they've asked that we send Romans 15:13 as their greetings. Now the love of the God of hope fill you all with all joy and peace in believing, that ye may abound in hope through the power of the Holy Spirit. We thought that we might, this morning, continue in the vein which we were meditating upon last evening. Yesterday, for those of you who were privileged to be here, we heard an hour and a half study on our theme text, understanding what the will of the Lord is. And in that in-depth study, Brother Larry walked us through the various steps in which we may discern and understand the will of God. And as you all have his outline, you can see the syllabus, a rather complete analysis of how we can discern, perceive, incorporate, and then perform what we understand to be the will of God concerning each and every one of us. And in that objective, the will of God as defined in terms of his overall plan, what is his ultimate goal? Determined to be the blessings of all the families of the earth. God will have all men to be saved and come to a knowledge of the truth. And now the intermediate steps whereby that program may be implemented and how the divine plan of the ages it works out that plan of salvation. And in that process, he spoke of the identifying the will of God. And once that is done, absolute dependence, obedience, and confidence in that plan must be realized in order to be pleasing to the Lord. And in that effort, there is the development of godliness, or there is the suffering that is involved in to bring this about, but there is also the joy. There is the love that is to be the fruits of the Spirit, but then there is also the fear lest we come short of any promise. And then there is the peace. The peace of God that surpasses all understanding, which is then the result of all this process of discerning the Lord's will. And in all of this, we are to learn a righteousness, and we are to do so within the parameters of God's character. We are to do so within the functioning of our free individual moral agency, and in the liberty of Christ, we are to then develop these fruits of the Spirit and of righteousness. Yes, all of this is encompassed in discerning, understanding what the will of the Lord is. And in that great process, and in that work which we are committed to do during this blessed opportunity of the high calling in the gospel age, we are now called upon to follow in the footsteps of our Master, because this is the will of God concerning you, even your sanctification. And in that work, then, of discerning what the will of God is, each moment of our days is confronted with choices. Who shall we go to the left or to the right? What shall be our next program? Where, what does the Lord want me to do from one moment to the next? Our decisions are ongoing. And we are subject to numerous forces, both within ourselves and about us. And there are many impediments emanating from internally, from the flesh, externally, from the world, and from our great adversary, the devil. And each of these are having their impact over our decision-making, our decisions as to what is the will of God concerning us, so that we might work together with God in this great divine program for blessing. And thus, we are to be on the alert each moment of our day, so that we would be in the will of God. You know, we as human beings have our sensory apparatus. That is to say, we are all bound within the parameters of five senses. And with these God-given physical powers, we are able to discern the external environment as all about us, and then incorporate all of that environment into our decision-making process, so that we then may be able to respond to those stimuli in a response that will be consistent with that will of the Lord. And so we have these five senses with which we function, with which we operate as human beings. And without them, there could be no life as we know it on the human level. Because each of these sensory senses are geared to our survival. And in that, we are able to see that by the incorporation of them, we are making proper decisions for our own safety and well-being. When, for example, at home, the housewife smells an odor, she runs into the kitchen and realizes there that her pot is boiling over and she must immediately turn off the flame. Or when the child reaches forth to touch the radiator and the heat of that radiator causes pain and the hand is removed. Or when the pedestrian walking across the street hears the horn of an automobile or sees a car hurling towards him, he immediately recoils and jumps out of the way. Or when there is a taste and somehow it is bland or it is not quite seasoned properly, the chef will make the necessary seasonings to bring it up to his standard of cuisine. And so all of these senses, that is, touch, taste, smell, sight, and hearing, are all means whereby we are able to know what is happening around and within ourselves. And then with this information, we are able to react in order to survive and to further our well-being. So as these impulses are all received, they are then processed. Thousands of bits of information are constantly being bombarded, and they come through these five organs, and then they are processed through a most marvelous of instrument, this brain, billions of tissues, of nerve tissues with its necessary components, and in a mystery which is to me the most wonderful creation of the physical organism, of the physical creation. As great as the quasars and as great as the novas and as great as the supernovas are in the astronomical heavens, they are nothing compared to the power and into the wisdom and into the infinite ability which is just packed into the manufacture or to the creation of the brain. Processes are going on which is so mysterious that mankind cannot begin to imagine. And so all of that information is processed through this one organ, and by that then the body is coordinated to its own self-defense and to its own objectives in life. Now what is true then of the physical natural realm is certainly true of the spiritual realm as well. Now this sensory response apparatus is operating in our spiritual lives as well. In the human family, back in the Garden of Eden, there was this stimulus, brain, response, and action. In the garden, it is said that God walked, or Adam walked with God. And I'm sure that in that fellowship in which he, as a perfect human being, was in heart communion with his Father, and there was a relationship that was difficult for anyone to conceive of because we cannot imagine as human beings what it would have been. And during those 2 years in which they were together, oh, Adam must have just rejoiced to speak about the animals, to speak about the wonders of creation about him, and how they just fellowshipped. There was every morning, I'm sure, they cry, "Adam, where art thou?" And there Adam was running to commune with the Father, and there they had that blessed communion. But then one day that same call came, "Adam, where art thou?" Adam did not run towards God, but he ran in the opposite direction. The account says that he hid. What had happened? There had now come into that apparatus now an interruption. There had come interference. And so no longer was the communication with God, because sin entered into Adam's experience. And thus there was then this brain, shall we say, been polluted, contaminated, corrupted, and thus he was out of favor, out of harmony, and he was therefore cursed and into the undefinished environment of the earth, there in the sweat of his brow to labor. And thus, alienation from God, and thus, out of the will of God, then the process of now then, how do we return to that divine favor which was in God's plan? And thus, it is so necessary then for us to then, in harmony with God, and to carry out his will for us, to then learn what conditions God has imposed upon us, so that we might be able to process the thoughts of men from the evil to the good that God has planned and store for those who are in harmony with him. So God's purpose is to restore to that former condition of relationship which Adam interrupted, save all families of the earth through his Abrahamic seed, and to reconnect with his human creatures. But within the parameters, or within the limits of his character, and of their liberty and choice and free will. Actually, Saul of Tarsus was a prime example of man trying to connect with God. You remember Saul of Tarsus on his way to Damascus for the mission of persecuting the church, routing out this new heresy, putting to the death those who would conflict with the law of Moses. And you recall that he, in his upbringing, and with such conviction, he was under that law, a Pharisee of the Pharisees, and concerning the law, blameless. And in this eager zeal for what he believed to be true, he was seated at the feet of the most learned rabbis, steeped in the Talmud and in the Torah, and in the verbal law, and in all of the commentaries of the Hebraic tradition. And when, thinking he was doing and understanding what the will of Jehovah would be, he then was confronted on the road to Damascus. You all know the story of immediately then the condition of his heart was clearly delineated when the first thought that he had at that sight of our risen Lord was, "Lord, what will thou have me to do?" There was nothing at all wrong with Saul of Tarsus' heart, but everything was wrong with his comprehension and understanding of what the will of God would be. And thus, for 3 days he was sheltered. For 3 days he was meditating and praying, and while he realized the scales of his sight, of his eyes were just heavy and he could not see, he was blinded. But when Ananias came to minister unto him and to tell him that God now has anointed him to be a special messenger, and that he would bear much for the glory of this Messiah whom he had been persecuting, then we see that Saul of Tarsus first saw that this was the will of God concerning him. And all of Paul's life thereafter was helping the brethren, his Hebraic brethren, and latterly the Gentiles, to recognize what the will of God was. And he was able to give us in such beautiful terms the relationship between the old and the new, and for his Hebraic brethren, how he was able to clarify the relationship of Moses to Christ, of the Mosaic priesthood and the Melchizedek priesthood, and of the typical sacrifices in the tabernacle, and then the greater sacrifices, the gospel age sacrifices in Christ. And we see how he was able to show the dichotomy, to show the distinction between the flesh and the spirit, and how the spirit and flesh were interacting. And he was able then to cast off that yoke of the law, whereby he was attempting to find salvation and to understand God's will through the works of the law, and recognize that by faith now we are in Christ. And you remember how in that wonderful book of Romans, and in those chapters from the 6th through the 8th, how he beautifully and so consolingly and so helpfully described the relationship, this dichotomy of the flesh and the spirit, and how he is able to so encouragingly to us all identify the fact that, yes, there is sin within us, and we do sin and we fail and we come short all the while, but yet it is not I that do this, but yet it is a sin that dwelleth in me. For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, sold unto sin. For that which I do, I allow not. For what I would, that I do not. But what I hate, that I do. And then he so beautifully shows that it is the sin that dwelleth in our flesh, in which there is no good thing. And how, however, because we delight in the law of God after the inward man, and we recognize that there is this law of sin in our members warring against the law of our minds, and we find that now we can find salvation. Now we can find release from this shackles of sin and death of the flesh. And oh, wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from the body of this death? And then the triumphant, victorious exaltation. I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then with the mind I myself serve the law of God, but with the flesh the law of sin. That awareness, that capacity to be able to differentiate, now we see that we, imperfect though we are now able to grasp the perfect will of God, and then through Christ by faith to perform the same. Oh, how reassuring if we had not these blessed, unequivocal, clear statements of our relatedness and our redemption through Christ, how it would surpass our comprehension or understanding. But with this clear denunciation or enunciation, are we able to grasp it by faith and, in the joy of the Lord, make it our own. And then in emphasizing that same point, again, we hear that Paul assures us of this relationship of knowing God now, not after the flesh, but according to the Spirit. For he says, "But as it is written, eye hath not seen nor ear heard, neither have entered into the heart of man the things which God hath prepared for them that love him. But God hath revealed them unto us by his Spirit, for the Spirit searcheth all things, yea, the deep things of God. For what a man knoweth the things of a man, save the spirit of man which is in him? Even so the things of God knoweth no man, but the Spirit of God. Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit which is of God, that we might know the things that are freely given to us of God." Again, We now have the means whereby distinction may be made between the works of the human, the carnal, the fleshly, and now the works of the Spirit, comparing spiritual things with spiritual things. And then also again, to further punctuate and to assist us in our understanding of our spiritual relationships, we also have Galatians 5, 16 and 17. And this was touched upon nicely last night about how our walk in the Ephesians 5, 17 verses, six components of our spiritual lives and our doing the will of the Father. And one of them being our walk in the Lord, and how in Galatians the same point is emphasized. This I say then, walk in the Spirit, and ye shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. For the flesh lusteth against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh. And these are contrary, the one to the other, so that ye cannot do the things that ye would. But if ye be led of the Spirit, ye are not under the law. Ah, brethren, that is such a blessed assurance that now we are in the Spirit. And being in the Spirit, we are now to relate to the will and the law of God. I want to call your attention, and this will be the main thrust of my remarks this morning, to a little article, or a little poem really, that we have in the Watchtowers in the year of 1910. Reprint 4580. It's a poem entitled The Christian's Battle. And it was brought to my attention recently, and I think it gives us the framework in which we might be able to understand this dichotomy between the flesh, the old creature, and the Spirit, the new creature, and somewhat of the interaction that happens between them in the making of our decisions each moment of our lives. Because there is a very subtle and a very determined relationship between the two. And in this little poem, apparently a sister, Rebecca Faradoni, tries to outline the dialogue between the two, confronting a particular situation, how the flesh responds, and what is the new creature's answer. And in that, I think, I received a little more insight as to the deceptiveness of the humanity, and how our constant need is to re-examine and to readjust, and to suppress so much of that which we entertain in our minds, and so much which is suggested unto us by our flesh and by the world and the adversary as well. And it is, I think, a very penetrating and a very personal kind of experience which I'm sure Sister Doni must have had. It's entitled The Christian's Battle, and it has ten verses and five sections. The first part of each section is the old creatures presenting, as it were, a case problem, and then the new creature responding to that problem and giving its solution, and how consistent the solution had been to what we were meditating and studying in depth last night. In that solution, the final answer always comes back to, it is written. It always comes back to what is given and revealed, always helping us to see what precedence have we in discerning God's will, and then having the ability, having the willingness, having the honesty, having the consecration to be able to apply those principles into the given situation and problem. The first verse. Old creature, your brother has offended you. Must you forgiveness show when he has not forgiveness asked? I really do not know that you are called to go that far. He's very much to blame, of course. I would not slander him nor injure his good name. But then, I think I'd show him, too, that he has quite offended you. Now, that is a practical, real, concrete situation that many, if not all of us, have experienced at one time or another. We have an offense. We have been hurt. And oh, I'm sure that sometimes it's very painful, because where there's flesh, there's pain. And in that hurt, we have been aggrieved against. Yes, we've done what we thought was best. We meant it all for good. But yet it was so unappreciated. Our flesh says, yes, you have a grievance. But you must be tolerant. You must not, react necessarily in kind. To be sure, he's very much to blame. But of course, you would not want to slander him either, nor injure his good name. But that sounds so godlike. But yet the flesh would, as it were, slip in. But then I think I'd show him, too, that he has quite offended you. The flesh suggests, now it's true, you have a grievance, and maybe you ought not to retaliate, but yet you ought to let him know that something is not right here. It doesn't tell you how. We're not given the circumstances, but it would appear that as though the flesh is saying, well, yes, you've been hurt, and therefore now you've got to let you've got to try to settle matters. Well, maybe we do. But as the prophet Jeremiah did say, that the heart, the human heart, is deceitful above all things, desperately wicked above all things, and who can know it? That word deceitful has the thought of being crooked. It's not as though there were something completely foreign and something that is unrelated. Rather, the thought of crookedness, just being a little bit off center, and which, if one persists in that crooked course, will bring us far afield from where we ought to be, and desperately wicked. That is, it's incurable in its own sin. And the prophet says that this condition is above all things. In other words, this crookedness and this incurability of sin is a part of everything that you do, because you are born in sin and shaped in iniquity. And thus, who can know it? Who knows at what point the flesh is crooked and would push us off course into a direction for which we shouldn't go? How similar that is to David's prayer in the 19th Psalm. Cleanse thou me from secret faults. Keep me back from presumptuous sin. Who can know it? There are then these inclinations, these suggestions, these, whether it is endocrine, physical, or just mental, emotional, developmental parts of our upbringing, which are a part of our human psyche, and which consciously, semi-consciously, or unconsciously are causing our responses and behavior. The heart is deceitful above all things, desperately wicked. And thus, when the old flesh would say, yes, I think I'd show him too that he has quite offended you, how careful one must be that we not use that as a cover for the flesh to perhaps respond in a manner which would not be godlike. Oh yes, this quality of forgiveness. As one would then survey the problem and pray to the Lord as to what one's course would be. And what do we do when we do come to impasses one with the other? Well, I'm sure each of us has our own degree of development and our own manner of solving some of our problems. But I do think I can say that the first thing we would do is come to the Lord in prayer. And then the next thing we would do is certainly to seek his word. Where is there any clues? Where is there any guiding principle? Where are there any precedents that we might call upon so that we might adjust our responses accordingly. Then perhaps we might go to our brethren, discuss it with them, not necessarily in detail, but rather in principle. What would be the proper will? How should one respond given this type of situation? And then do what we can, and then if there is no immediate resolution or any immediate suggested manner, then we just have to wait upon the Lord. Let the Lord take care of the matter, and let us not try to resolve it without having an understanding or a clear indication that this is the will of God for us in this condition. Oh, the most, I'm sure, the most classic example of forgiveness was that of Joseph. If anyone had a quarrel, if anyone could say that his brethren had offended him, it was he, how he was sold into slavery. And you know how after his experience in Potiphar's household and he was so falsely accused, and 3 years in that prison dungeon languishing away, and then you recall how he was given this blessed opportunity to then interpret Pharaoh's dream and elevated to his right hand, as it were, the prime minister of the Egyptian Empire. And recall the opportunity he had for vengeance. The revenge, sweet as the world would express it, how he had those brethren who had offended him in such a manner in his grasp. But oh, the tenderness, the love, the compassion, and the warmth of forgiveness that he manifested. You see, Joseph knew that there was a divine purpose. According to the principles that we were undergoing last evening, he was able to see that there was confidence that he was in relationship with Jehovah. He knew that he was absolutely dependent upon his God for his destiny. And in perfect obedience thereto, he was willing to let Jehovah direct his path and his steps. And it directed him to the point of forgiveness. Because he said, "You, brethren, you intended for me for evil, but God intended it for good, that life may be spared and saved." You see, he was endeavoring to learn what the will of Jehovah was in his life. And in discerning that, he knew that if he was maintaining his integrity, keeping intact the character that he believed that the Lord would have, Jehovah would have him live, he was then willing to endure whatever of conditions in the full confidence that this obedience would be resulting in ultimate success and harmony with God. And in his life, he believed that all things would work together for good. And then we see, too, David is another example of forgiveness. Oh, how we could just elaborate on that. You know, David, because of his own problems with family life, and brethren, never was there a family more confused than the families of David, with his intermarriage with various women, and how the court, where his home, his domicile, was so confused, and he was so concerned with affairs of state, there was apparently a lack of perhaps supervision at home. And there we have an Absalom coming along and now aspiring to take over the throne. And you remember there was a coup d'etat, and David had to flee in his bare feet for his life. And as he was fleeing, going into exile, as it were, while his son Absalom was now proclaiming himself as king, as David was fleeing away from Absalom's vengeance or Absalom's threat of death, he was met by this Benjaminite, this son of Saul, who inwardly was rebellious against David and his assumption of the throne. And how this one Shimei, you recall, and it is found in the second book of Samuel, how he was so abusive. And in the 16th chapter, we read of his rebellion against David. When David, it says in the 5th verse, "And when King David came to Bahurim, behold, hence came out a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. He came forth and cursed still as he came, and he cast stones at David, and at all the servants of King David, and all the people, and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. And thus said Shimei when he cursed, 'Come out! Come out, thou bloody man, and thou man of Belial. The Lord hath returned upon thee all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose stead thou hast reigned, and the Lord hath delivered the kingdom into the hands of Absalom thy son. And behold, thou art taken in thy mischief, because thou art a bloody man.'" Can you imagine? Add to the plight of desperate flight, to the plight of a palace rebellion, now this son of Saul, son of Benjamin, he would now curse in such an obscene and in such a vulgar manner. And of course, Abishai, one of David's leaders and one of his faithful men of arms, he said, "Why should this dead dog curse the Lord my king? Let me go over, I pray thee, and take off his head." And certainly Abishai, with just one swish of a sword, would have just caused Shimei's head to roll. But no. David said to Abishai and to all his servants, "Behold, my son, which came forth of my bowels, seeketh my life. How much more now may this Benjamite do it? Let him alone. Let him curse. The Lord hath bidden him." Oh, yes. Now we see David's tenderness. Yes, a man after God's own heart. "It may be that the Lord will look on mine affliction, and that the Lord will requite me good for his cursing this day." And as David and his men went by the way, Shimei went along on the hill's side over against him and cursed as he went and threw stones at him and cast dust. Forgiveness. There David, in the midst of all his personal anxiety and tragedy, let him alone. David knew that there was a penalty upon him for his sin against with Bathsheba. And he knew that this was a part of it. And he knew that, well, it is the Lord. Let him do what seemeth him good. Forgiveness. So when a brother or sister offends us, oh, the old man will cry out in vengeance. Or the old man might very subtly suggest, well, let us not be too severe, but let us just be a little severe. And in the poem, the new creatures answer, "How can I, a child of God, not show forgiveness? Why, he has covered all my sins. I must surely grow in that sweet grace which from the heart forgives by word and deed. I would be like the blessed Lord, for in his word I read that he left all the joys of heaven to die, that I might be forgiven." You see, the key, I think, to this verse is in that sweet grace which from the heart forgives by word and deed. It's in the heart. It is, we must forgive from the heart, and how the Master had emphasized this point, that if we don't forgive from the heart, not merely a matter of forgiving and forgetting, but rather just forgiving because God is forgiven, because we have been forgiven, because we have been the recipients of mercy, and we will only be given that mercy in proportion as we have conveyed it unto others. It is that way in which that new creature then might know and understand what the will of God is. Because we see the will of God expressed in the forgiveness that our Master was conveying to us by his death on Calvary's cross. Again, another condition, another situation, another reaction from the flesh. Old creature, your brother has imposed on you. Says, all that's thine is mine. It is not right. What shall you do? Why should you share your earthly goods which you by thrift acquired? That which you toil is for your own. And you are not required to give to everyone who comes to seek your help, your bread, your home. The matter of generosity. The flesh is saying here that someone is imposing on you and presuming. Why must you feel that you have to answer? Why do you feel you have to keep giving? You're not necessarily requiring to do that. And it's true. To everyone who asks or comes to seek your help, your bread, your home, you're not required to give unto them. But yet, we must ask, because that is true, does that mean that we ought to stop giving when the opportunity is still there? Oh yes, if there's presumption, we cannot encourage that. But on the other hand, how are we able to distinguish? You know, the disciples were concerned about the master. The master had been preaching all day. He was at a point of weariness. And there were these 5,000, and it was getting to be dark. Dinner time has come. They perhaps had not had much of a lunch. And he was depleting his inner strength, his resources. And the disciples said, oh, now that's enough. You've been giving so much all this time. Let them go. Let them discharge them, dismiss them. But he did not. Our master gave to the utmost. What did he do? He then performed that most wonderful of miracles, that feeding of the 5,000. He gave and he gave and he gave until there was no more to give. That is generosity. That is giving, not of your abundance, not of your surplus, but rather giving when it hurts. That is the spirit of generosity. And while we are to be discreet, we are to be wise in some of our disbursements of whatever we might be privileged to have as stewards of God's abundance, yet we are not in any way to have conditions, to have strings attached, or in any way to expect something in return. Oh, I wish we had more time to develop some of these points, but let us give the new creatures a response to the old man's feeling of, well, don't be too generous. I've often wished that I had lived when my Lord left his throne and trod this earth in human form, my love to him in service, that I might then have shown my love to him in service sweet. But still the suffering Christ walks by my side each day, and how neglected, poor, despised, still needing ministries of love. Now here's the chance my love to prove. And so the new creature says, there is opportunity, and wherever it is given, you are now showing your chance to prove your love, that you would do unto them as you would unto him. Inasmuch as ye have done unto the least of these, my brethren, ye have done unto me. There is no equivocation, and there can be no substitution. If you are Christ's, and if you are ministering one to another, you are ministering to Christ. If only we can always bear that in mind, that we are Christ's body in the flesh. We would then no longer see each other as human beings. We would then see each other as new creatures. Henceforth, know we no man after the flesh. Case history number 3. Old creature, your brother shows no gratitude for all your kindly deeds. He surely should express some thanks when you supply his needs. You've loaned, you've given, you've gone without. You've helped them all you could. I really think in counting up, you've done more than you should. I'd call a halt till he has seen how very kind you've always been. Well now, here is the flesh, saying, now there's the sin of ingratitude. And you know that sin of ingratitude is a a very difficult one to experience. I remember as a boy reading in Shakespeare when it said, "Blow, blow, thou bitter wind, thou art not so unkind as ingratitude." Even the world recognizes that ingratitude is a hurtful sin. But yet the flesh says, "I call a halt. Phil, he has seen how very kind you've always been." One would have to question, what is the motive? Why must the brother say thanks? Well, we would like to have him do so, but if we know that he is at a point of need, if we know that his ability or his point of development is such where he may not be able to verbalize, he may not be able to manifest in the way that we think he ought to, should that mean that we would love him less or that we would withhold what good we could do? Or rather, would we not want to manifest by our showing our love where there may not be as much response? Would we not thereby instruct and to help by our example to elevate our brother to a higher level? You know, the master cured 10 lepers, and how they were so happy to be cured. And I can just imagine how they, when they realized that that infirmity, that curse had been removed from them, how they were free, and now they felt their life was now going to begin anew. 9 of them went forth in that life, and they just went about their affairs. Only one came back to say thank you. And the Lord asked the question, "Where are the other 9? And then to the one he said, "Go thy way, thy faith hath made you whole." Now the other 9 went their way, but they did not have the blessing. They did not have the wholeness that this one leper did have, because he did not have the sin of ingratitude. He realized the source of his blessings, and he was going to pay reverence and homage and thanksgiving for that grace. And so, dear friends, how ingratitude is a difficult thing to respond to, and it's basically selfishness. It's the concern for what one is to get, and emphasis upon the receiving rather than upon the giver. You know, we are all beneficiaries of God's grace. But until we get behind the grace and see the glory of the benefactor, are we really able to render to God the praise and the love and the devotion of which he is worthy? We are sometimes so caught up in the results rather than we don't see the origin of our blessings. Now again to we see the new creature's response. New creature's response to this complaint of the flesh that we're not getting sufficient recognition or we're not being given sufficient appreciation for all of our magnificence. What? Work for thanks? Then I should lose a future rich reward. All service to my brother now is done to my dear Lord. Each little sacrifice I make is precious in his sight. To see my love and zeal abound, I know is his delight. For all the wealth beneath the sun, I would not miss his sweet well done. You see, the new creature was laying up treasures in heaven. The new creature realized that we have whatever we have of today is all by his overruling power and grace. And whatsoever we have is laid upon that altar of sacrifice. And now what we ought to do is simply sending before our little basket of love and our treasures and our all, so that it is in heaven waiting for us to complete our emptying process here, the consummation of our sacrifice, so that we might then rest from our labors and have our work follow us. Again, number 4. The old creature says, "Your brother slandered you, I hear, and tried on you to throw suspicious base to injure you, told things that were not so, surmised that you had evil done, tells others of his fears, while with coolness meet your looks of love, and cost you many tears. You do not owe him in return the love which he will only spurn. Yes, that is what the flesh says. Why should you love him? Look at, he's only trying to do you evil. But the new creature says, love your enemies. Do good to those who despitefully use you. And the new creature's response, it is not my brother you hold up. It is not his faults you show. It is my brother's enemy, like you, a deadly foe. My brother does not do the things that you lay at his door. Tis his old nature that one day shall trouble him no more. The new creature is my kin. The new creature does no sin. Now that is magnanimity. That is love. That is agape love. It's looking beyond the sinner, looking beyond the day, looking unto the day when that sinner will be able to be free of that limitation. Seeing the potential in that individual so that they are looking to what the outcome might be rather than what the present is. And in that potential, they are able to manifest love and to show the example and to give them the climate which is needed to raise them from this condition of undoneness. Oh, brethren, by our faith, by our consistency, by our example, how we can illustrate and how we can influence one another. And let us not be stingy. Let us not be limiting in our love for one another. I often think of, and I'm sure you do too, of our Master at that last, we call it the Last Supper, and that memorial service which he instituted. You remember that at that time he washed feet. He washed the feet of all the disciples. And of course, he washed the feet of Judas, knowing all the while that in the moment he was going to betray him, that even then he was scheming and was already prepared to sell and betray his master. And yet Jesus loved Judas, even to Judas's end. He knew what was in that heart lurking. And he knew that Satan was just at the portals. He knew that the cross was right before him. Yet he never ceased to love all mankind. We are to have the self-disinterested agape love. Love for the sinner, even though we hate the sin that's in him. And even though we see him afflicting us in ways that are hurtful, we yet are willing to invest and know that God is still working with him. Don't give up. I will show him by my love, my example. And in that process, we might reclaim our dear brother. You know, where there's flesh, as we said earlier, there is hurt. And when there is hurt, maybe we ought to ask, where perhaps is the flesh entering in, and how does the new creature curtail that? Then our last case situation, the old creature says, your brother claims he walks in love. Then why is he so mean? In many people of the world, there is more goodness seen than he shows in his daily life. You know, you're vexed with him. He has such ugly little ways and such besetting sins. He surely lacks in Christian grace. Now, how can he win in the race? This matter of judgment, this matter of judging one another and how quickly the flesh wants to jump to conclusions. He surely lacks in Christian grace. Now, how can he win in the race? Brethren, how we need to guard ourselves against such conclusions. If God is dealing with one another, and God is dealing with myself, we will never allow the sin of discouragement to interrupt our communication with our Heavenly Father. We will never doubt that he who has begun this good work in us is able to complete it and to bring it to fruition, if only we have sufficient confidence and faith to know that we're dealing with the God of the universe, that his power is unlimited, and that he wouldn't have called you and myself unless he knew that we would be able to make our calling and election sure if we would be faithful and consistent and willing to understand and know what the will of the Lord is. As we are striving to walk in his way, he will always be there with us. And there may be clouds interfering, and there may be difficulties and stumbling blocks along the way. But we know that he who has led us thus will lead us still. And he will guide us unto our heavenly home. And judgment is in the hands of God. We are not to take that away from him and try to supplant him and make our own judgments. Oh, how necessary it is to not allow the humanity to interfere and to look at one another from the external, but rather let us see the inner purity, to see Christ in you. You know, I often think, and I've given a discourse on the beauty within. You remember, I think it was in the 16th century, in Florence, Italy, there was a cathedral. And in the cathedral, the authorities had commissioned a sculptor to sculpt a statue. And apparently the sculptor was very inexpert, and he had just ruined a huge piece of marble from the quarry that was nearby. And they had just discarded that piece as being worthless. And it was just in the backyard of the cathedral. And one day came to Florence a man by the name of Michelangelo. As he came by the cathedral, he saw this block of granite. It was so misshapen and so out of proportion that it was just looked upon as a piece of debris. And he said that he would like to have that piece of granite and to make a statue. The critics of Florence ridiculed and said no one could really make any piece of that misshapen form of granite. And so I understand that there was a kind of competition within the city as to what could be done with that piece of granite. And he contracted to try. And he built a scaffolding around that granite. And for 2 years, I understand that he was constructing. And behind that scaffolding, I'm sure there were the noise of hammers and of chisels, and the noise of grinding and sanding, whatever implements they may have used. And out of that misshapen form, when it came to the day of the unveiling of that statue and the city's fathers were there wondering what was going to come forth, and when they withdrew the scaffolding, there was before them one of the most beautiful pieces of art, of sculpture work, that mankind has ever seen, the statue of David. And there to this day in the city of Florence, it stands in its majestic pedestal, almost lifelike, almost as though the flesh were just as real and just as tender and just as natural and normal as a human's. There, out of that misshapen and from that broken piece of debris, was fashioned a statue of David. And another time, he was asked what he was going to do with that piece of marble that he was going to work on. And he was alleged to have answered, "I am seeking to release the angel captured within." I think that's the way we are. We are misshapen pieces of flesh from the Adamic stock. We are cast upon the debris of uselessness. We are born in sin, shapen in iniquity. But yet, the master sculptor is working upon us. The master sculptor is working upon you and I. Let that work go forward. And let no bystander, critic, wonder what is going to happen or how it can possibly be conformed into such a work of art that will withstand the requirements of eternity. Work of art which will be a new creature developed and conformed to the image of Christ, into which the immortal nature might be invested. How we then, brethren, need to remember the words of the new creature in the response to the old man saying, well, he surely lacks in Christian grace. Now how can he win in the race? Response being, the way is getting narrower, more steep and rough it grows, and few are they who walk therein. Lord, I would be of those who walk on to the very end, through good report or ill, my chief desire to know and do thy blessed holy will. Complete in me thy work of grace, that I may see thee face to face. That is the sentiment of the new creature.